Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Amir Barzin.
And we want to welcome you, Amir, who is one of our stellar resident physicians at UNC Family Medicine and who is filling in today for Adam while he is away. Thank you for being with us, Amir.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to it.
On our show today, Amir, we get to talk with Professor George Annis, who is the chair of the Department of Health Law, Bioethics, and Human Rights of Boston University School of Public Health, about life at Guantanamo, the unspoken truth. This will be certainly an important topic related to his recent New England Journal article about Guantanamo Bay.
I'm looking forward to it, Christy. But first, let's talk about some research that matters.
We're going to talk about the padding of your shoes and running injuries, about kissing and sorting out potential mates.
Also talking today about some health screening risks and what doctors do to inform our patients.
And about breast milk bought online. Let's get started, Amir. The first one, you know, there's a lot of marketing that goes into shoes. I just bought running shoes for my daughter, and there's a lot that goes into thinking, well, what's best for her little foot? Should she have more padding or less padding or what?
Yeah, and I totally agree, because this is something that I like to do in my spare time, and I think I've fallen victim of buying shoes based off of the padding and what different marketing companies have used for it.
Yeah, so this was a study that looked at 250 regular runners at factors like their body weight, overall fitness, and the softness and thickness of their shoes to see if there was any difference in injury rates based on those shock absorption characteristics of shoes.
And what the study found is that the only difference was that the shoes that they were given to half the participants had a little bit of a softer sole that allowed for more of this shock absorption versus a normal sole given to the other half. And there was no difference in injuries given to those who had the more shock-absorbing shoes, even though they might have cost more money in a retail market.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think certainly more study needs to be done, but this does not support the marketing strategies that sort of really push those thickness and shock absorption characteristics. I think if they feel good to your foot and that's most comfortable to you, we want you exercising, so whatever it takes. But you may not need all of those extra little special Nike things that they put out there, or whatever brand it is.
Absolutely. And the only thing that actually did find to decrease injury was people who had a previous running experience and higher level of participation in other sports. So going along with the fact that activity is important.
Well, let's talk about kissing. This is an interesting study. And it turns out that kissing plays a role in helping men and women sort out potential mates. And they were able to study this in a British study from Oxford University.
Yes, what they did is they actually looked at 900 people to confirm if kissing played a central role in finding a future partner. And what they found is that women rated kissing more important in relationships than men. And they also found those in short-term relationships, both men and women, said that kissing was important before having sex, but not as important during and after sex.
They also found that more frequent kissing in a relationship was linked to the quality of that relationship, while that wasn't the case for the frequency of actually having intercourse. So just some reflection of kissing helping sort out potential mates and then also being some player or some piece of the puzzle in the quality of that relationship. Interesting stuff.
Very interesting. And the next study that we were going to talk about is how doctors rarely discuss the risk of cancer screening. And this was an article that was from the Max Planck Institute for Human Development in Berlin. And it was published in the JAMA Internal Medicine Journal. And it surveyed 317 American adults in their 50s and 60s.
And it was interesting. I don't know if I ask you, Amir, do you feel like you talk to most patients about the risks of screening?
I think that that's one thing that we try to do in our day-to-day work as a family physician. But I can see how sometimes the constraints of a tough clinic and a packed clinic can make it a little bit more difficult to relay those efforts.
Well, and also I think most people just assume that the more you check for stuff, the better. And we're not necessarily all wired to think about the harms of what we call overdiagnosis, where you find something that looks like cancer but isn't, or is cancer but is so small or so slow growing that it may not actually cause any harm to the patient if they didn't know about it. But there's a lot of harm when they're worried about having cancer. So in this case, they found in this study that less than 1 in 10 said their doctor had even brought up the chance of this concept of overdiagnosis or overtreatment when talking about cancer screening.
Absolutely. And 80% of those studied, though, said that they would have wanted to be told about these harms. And the interesting part about this is that the people said that they would actually continue the screenings that they've already been taking, even though they didn't know of the risks. But they said that 69% of those would not want to start a new screening test if they had known that there could have been harm done with the screenings.
And so I think this is just another thing that highlights the need to have shared decision making as we are challenged to really educate our patients and make sure that we're on the same page with their values and with understanding both the benefits and the risks to screening for different types of cancer.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about breast milk bought online. I think just reading that out loud doesn't sound like a great idea, although we support breastfeeding for sure as a gift of great nutrition. What do you think?
Absolutely. We try to encourage our new mothers to breastfeed as much as possible because of the benefits of breastfeeding. And there are a certain population of females who cannot produce enough breast milk or do not have the ability to use their own breast milk when wanting to feed for their own infants. So they look at things like a breast bank to get milk, but sometimes the restraints of the milk that's available through the breast banks leads them to looking at online sources so that they can purchase milk.
So in this study, they purchased 101 samples anonymously online, and then they tested them from different bacteria, and they found that nearly three-quarters of the samples contained bacteria that could make a baby sick, including some batches that were positive for Salmonella.
And interestingly enough, they also looked at other viruses that could be found in the breast milk, and they found that none of them had AIDS and none of them had CMV, which is a very common virus but can lead to danger in premature infants or those with diseases that make them immunocompromised.
I think the take-home message here is that, you know, of course we support breastfeeding. I think breast banks and donor milk done through hospitals where they purify it and where they test it and where it's in a more controlled environment can be really beneficial and is a good option for many people. But buying it blindly online, at least based on this, sounds like it certainly has some risks that you should be aware of when you do that and really consider that before just making an online purchase of body fluids.
Absolutely. And making sure to look into things of how the milk was obtained and whether or not it is screened appropriately. And another thing that they did mention that was important is that the packaging, no matter whether it was packaged in ice or containers that held for temperature, made no difference. So it really is the source that is the important thing to think about.
So we've had a chance to talk a little bit about breast milk bought online and potential risks there, about doctors rarely discussing risk of cancer screening and our need to challenge ourselves to do that,
about how important kissing may be to finding your future mate and to the maintenance of a good marriage,
and about extra padded shoes might not actually prevent running injuries. Now, that does conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, Amir and I will be talking with Professor George Annis about medical ethics and life at Guantanamo, the unspoken truth. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Amir Barzin and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Amir Barzin and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Professor George Annis about medical ethics, life at Guantanamo, the unspoken truth.
And we are so excited to have Dr. Annis with us who is a distinguished professor and chair of the Department of Health Law, Bioethics, and Human Rights of Boston University School of Public Health, has many other titles and accomplishments in his life, but most recently wrote a very captivating article in the New England Journal of Medicine about Guantanamo Bay. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Annis.
Happy to be with you.
So tell us a little bit about your story and what drove you to become so involved and passionate about human rights.
Well, I've always been interested in human rights. I'm a lawyer who teaches in a medical school. So I've always been interested in patients' rights and human rights. And after 9/11, it became an issue in the United States. I'd say before that, I think it was seen that we were the leader in human rights across the globe, and we could tell other countries how to improve their human rights records. Now other countries are telling us how we can improve our human rights records, and we don't like that. But I think at least in terms of Guantanamo, they're absolutely correct that this Guantanamo is a disgrace both to the U.S. government, but especially to the physicians in the United States who have to see both medical ethics and medical practice just done very badly at Guantanamo.
Dr. Annis, thank you for that comment. And one of the things that I really took away from the article whenever I read it is the fact that you have this degree in law. And in your article, you actually mentioned that Guantanamo is a legal black hole. Can you describe to our listeners what you meant by this?
Yeah, surely. Actually, that was not original with me. It was called the legal black hole by a lord, I can't remember his name, in England, who was commenting on the fact that a number of U.K. Citizens were prisoners at Guantanamo back in 2005, actually. And what we mean by legal black hole is that the laws of nations, humanitarian or the law of war, the Geneva Convention, or the U.S. Constitution, none of them applied there. That the U.S. government had set this prison camp up in a place that they believed, and we're talking about the Bush administration initially, that no law applied, that they could just write the rules themselves. And they did. And you couldn't even challenge them in the U.S. courts until after 2005.
And you mentioned in your article something about sort of the challenge that places on physicians who are bound to a certain code of conduct, but then in this black hole where the same ethics may be blurry or different. Help us understand what that means.
Well, I think physicians at Guantanamo especially, they're all military physicians, number one. So they have the first, what has often been a confusion between whether their first loyalty is to the military mission or to be a physician to their patient, you know, and most military medical physicians understand that they're physicians. That's not a question of being a physician first and a military officer second. You're always a physician, and your obligation as a physician is to act in the best interest of your patient. And 99 times out of 100, there will be absolutely no problem, no pushback for doing that. But when you're in a prison situation, and especially when you're in Guantanamo, and your patients are all prisoners, and worse than that, they've been designated by the President of the United States as the worst of the worst, and terrorists and enemies of the country, it's very difficult for you to say no when you get an order from the base commander to do something that you think may be questionable in terms of ethics.
So give us an example of a type of order or situation between a patient and physician that might put a doctor in that kind of situation?
Well, probably the easiest one is the force feeding. I mean, in 2005, a couple hundred of the prisoners at Guantanamo went on a hunger strike to protest the conditions there. And the military decided to order that they be force-fed, and not just force-fed in a nonviolent way, but force-fed in a violent way. They actually brought these things that are called restraint chairs onto the base, 25 of them, and literally strapped the person into the chair using restraints on their ankles, their wrists, their chest, and their head, and then forcing an NG tube, nasogastric tube, up their nose, down their esophagus, and tube to pour Infamil into them twice a day.
So they strapped them down, pushed the tube through their nose, and basically just force-fed them through the tube.
Exactly.
And said, you have to eat. We're not going to let you.
Right. And then kept them in the chair for a half hour to an hour after that so they wouldn't be able to regurgitate or do anything to counteract the procedure.
So what kind of ethical issues and sort of, as we're thinking about that on this side, I could see how some people would say, well, you're feeding them, and but obviously it raises a lot of ethical issues. How do you break that down for regular
folks? Well, a lot of people
folk?
Say, it's their own fault. If they don't want to eat, then they won't be force-fed, number one. And number two, if they're really on a hunger strike to die, they're suicidal, and you have an obligation to save their lives. And those are very similar arguments that used to be made in the United States for everyday patients, right? Karen Quinlan, Nancy Kruzan, even Terry Schiavo, people used to argue that there's no right to refuse treatment, especially if you're going to die if you don't get, fluids and nutrition, so that should be mandatory. Doctors should have to force you to have fluids and nutrition, whether you want them or not. And, that's never been the law. It's never been medical ethics. Competent patients have the right to refuse any treatment, including life-sustaining treatment. And in 1991 first, and then again in 2006, the World Medical Association issued specific guidelines on force-feeding hunger strikers in prison. And they said what you expect medical ethicists and physicians to say, that your first obligation is to the patient, and you cannot, under any circumstances, force feed competent people if you know they don't want to be fed.
And I think one point that you made in your article that was interesting to tie this back into a medical situation that maybe more people are familiar with is the ability for competent people to refuse dialysis when they are on dialysis.
No, exactly. And we know that almost all of them eventually just stop taking dialysis. You're right. And they're living at home. We don't send a police car to go get them and bring them into the dialysis center. They have a dialysis machine at home, they can shut it off and not use it at any time. Exactly correct.
And that's not considered, in terms of, is it suicide or not?
No, it's not. No one even thinks of that. The example I like to use is, because it happened in the middle of a national discussion of suicide, is when James Michener, who was on dialysis, had his publicist announce to the world that he was going off dialysis and expected to die within the next 7 days. People sent him lots of letters of condolences, of sorry, et cetera, but no one, and he was on national television, no one even suggested that he was committing suicide.
Hmm. And so that does have a parallel. People are choosing not to eat in this sort of argument of whether or not that's suicide.
Yes, that's right. Actually we have a U.S. Supreme Court decision on that. And the U.S. Supreme Court has said that is refusing treatment, but you have a right to refuse any treatment, including fluids and nutrition. And nobody can force you.
Okay. Well, we are
to be fed or treated.
We are looking forward to continuing this conversation. We do need to take a short break. But when we return, Amir and I will continue talking with our guest, Professor George Annis, about life at Guantanamo, the unspoken truth. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Amir Barzin and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Amir Barzin and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Professor George Annis from the Department of Health Law, Bioethics, and Human Rights of Boston University School of Public Health and School of Law about life at Guantanamo, the unspoken truth. And his recent New England Journal article about this and the multiple ethical issues that are raised at Guantanamo Bay. Thank you, Dr. Annis, for continuing the conversation with us.
You're welcome.
You know, in thinking about, in reading your article and in thinking about the challenges of knowing what's true and knowing what's real, really happening at a place like Guantanamo Bay, all we know as civilians are what we see in the media. How did you, how do you get your information and sort of sort out what is true and what's not true?
Well, you're absolutely right. It's difficult, so a lot of it secondhand sources. But my co-author, Dr. Sandra Crosby, has been to Guantanamo on multiple occasions, has examined the number of the prisoners there, and has brought back a lot of things she can't tell us because everything is top secret there, and she's has the security clearance. But she at least has firsthand experience there, and talks to the physicians when she goes down.
One of the things that I think is very important in medical ethical issues as a physician is that we sometimes get called in with our patients to make these difficult medical decisions and to help them along the process. And one of the points that I just wanted to harp on is the fact that you mentioned in your article that there's a constant physician turnover at Guantanamo. And what do you think this reason is for and how that affects the health and the ethical health of the people that are at Guantanamo?
Well, I mean, Guantanamo is not exactly a sought-after position.
It's not like what every doctor's in the military is dreaming to work there.
I'd like to go to Guantanamo for a while. So the fact they don't stay more than 6 months to a year is not surprising. I mean, nobody wants to stay there a long time. The other problem is that most of the physicians who go down there are young. They're right out of medical school or right out of residency, and this is like their first or second assignment. So they're not, you know, they're used to taking orders. They're not used to giving them. So it's very difficult. I see them more as co-victims in this whole thing rather than as perpetrators of some horrible crime.
It's such a formidable time of their career,
absolutely,
just getting used to being doctors and also figuring out that role as a military physician. I mean, I guess I really see your point that that's such a confusing time anyway in your professional life. And then having to have such challenging decisions and situations without much experience does put them in a really hard position.
No, they're in a very difficult position, I think. You know, even if you think what they're doing is wrong, they shouldn't be doing it, you have to have some sympathy for it. I mean, they're not going to be able to change the rules themselves.
Well, what happens?
In fact, we're told that they're not sent there, that they're questioned before they're sent there and asked if they have any trouble force-feeding suicidal prisoner. Uh-huh. And if they say, I couldn't do that, then they're not sent there. I don't know if that's true, but everyone says that's true.
Well, what would happen to a doctor at Guantanamo if they refused to follow orders? I mean, I can see how that would be unlikely if they've been brought up in a culture that they have to follow orders. But what if someone said, you know what, I'm not doing it?
You know, nobody knows the answer to that because I don't think anyone's done it. Theoretically, they could be court-martialed and thrown out of the military. But that's about the worst that could happen. I mean, that's bad because a lot of these soldiers, physicians want to be career military, but not all of them. But that could happen to them. Yeah, that's certainly the threat for disobeying an order.
So they could be like dishonorably discharged or something by trying to advocate for a detainee's health over their own career.
It's possible. I mean, the problem is that the orders, like the order to force feed, for example, doesn't come from the physician in charge of the naval hospital there. It comes from the commander, who is not a physician, from the commander of the armed forces there on Guantanamo. So you're getting ordered by a non-physician to do a medical act, and that's very problematic, just in itself.
Yeah, I could see how that could pose some conflict of interest for the physicians that are there. And how that translates into a very difficult ethical issue for both the members of the medical community at Guantanamo and the members who live in Guantanamo on a regular basis. Now, could the care that the prisoners at Guantanamo receive correlate in any way to the care that American patients receive stateside, and how would that impact shift the medical ethical thought of what is going on at Guantanamo?
Well, I think the closest analogy is, of course, in U.S. prisons. And I'm sure you know we have more prisoners in the United States than any other country in the world. And at the beginning of Guantanamo, the physicians there and the leaders there used to say that the medical care we deliver is consistent with that medical care delivered in U.S. prison. And, you know, they may be right about that because a lot of medical care in U.S. prisons is pretty horrible. I mean, it varies a lot across the country. But nonetheless, you know, certainly the mental health of U.S. prisoners is not well taken care of. And the mental health at Guantanamo is disastrous, actually.
And so, you know, you started out earlier on saying at one point the United States was thought of as the leader in human rights, and now it's other countries really chiming in and sort of implying maybe a little embarrassment of, you know, we have some things to learn and some areas to grow. What are the next steps? Like, what do we do about the fact that the healthcare at Guantanamo and also in the prison system has these ethical dilemmas that are perhaps not managed as well or as proudly as we should?
I mean, there's two different questions, but I mean, the president's right when he says we have to close Guantanamo. I'm not sure why he doesn't actually do that. I know that there are some political obstacles, but we have to close Guantanamo. It's an intolerable situation, and no good will ever come of Guantanamo. And whenever we tell other countries now you have to do X, Y, or Z, or you have to follow human rights, they just laugh at us and point at Guantanamo, and rightfully so, because we seem like we're just big hypocrites.
Mm-hmm. So get rid of that.
In terms of the U.S. prison system, I mean, there's lots of proposals now, but basically we got to start letting, you know, much shorter sentences, letting a lot of the nonviolent prisoners go, and then developing a decent mental health system for those who stay in prison, because they're all going to get out eventually, almost all.
Well, and I would add, only we come from a state that has a lot of challenges with mental health, and certainly in our prison system. And having systems to care for prisoners when they are released from prison to provide for their mental health is a key part of that as well.
Absolutely. No, there's no question about that. I mean, as you, I have to tell you, community mental health has been long neglected.
Well, it's certainly a privilege for us to have a chance to talk with you. We appreciate what you're doing to advocate for human rights and to advocate for our country becoming the leader again that we certainly can be. For our listeners who are wondering, just as I am, what are the best sources or where do we go to find out more about Guantanamo Bay and more about the ethical issues that you raise? What would be some good, credible sources for our listeners to seek out?
Okay, I'm going to give you two websites and one new publication.
All right.
The websites are the U.S. the Constitution Project, and you can just Google that and get their website in Washington,
Constitution
D.C.
Project.
And the other one is Global Lawyers and Physicians.
Global
Lawyers and Physicians.
And Physicians.
Okay, both of those have on their website some real up-to-date information on Guantanamo.
Fantastic. And we'll have our health sciences librarians make sure that we have accurate links up there and also a link to your article in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much for taking time with us.
And sure, thanks for having me.
All right.
Okay, bye-bye.
We have been talking and had the privilege to talk to Professor George Annis in his work with the New England Journal of Medicine article, Guantanamo Bay, a Medical Ethical Free Zone. Coming up on House Calls, we'll actually be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Amir Barzin and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Amir and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu.
Amir, we've got some good questions today. Something about MS or multiple sclerosis.
We also have information about birth control pills.
And a question about eating food after it has expired, and also about taking medicines after it has expired. So lots to talk about. Let's have our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, read us our very first house call question for today.
My neighbor and I have been friends for nearly 20 years. This past spring, he was diagnosed with MS after months of on and off instances of falling down the stairs and dizziness. He lives with his wife, who is a wonderful caregiver, but I'm afraid there will come a time, sooner rather than later, where he will be unable to maneuver in their two-story home. I don't want to overstep my boundaries, but I want what's best for them. I know there is no cure, but is there any advice you could give to this couple?
Well, it sounds like you are a very caring friend and loyal neighbor, and we certainly appreciate you sharing what sounds like a really difficult situation for this lovely couple, and also for you as you are involved and engaged in supporting them. Amir, what kind of ideas do you have? Well, you know, I guess first for our listeners who might not know much about MS, we're talking about multiple sclerosis, which is a chronic disease that can be very disabling. It attacks the brain, the spinal cord, different nerves in the body, and how far it progresses, how severe it gets, and which specific symptoms of MS can really vary from one person to another. But in this case, it sounds like your neighbor has a pretty significant severity of this disease.
Absolutely. And it's very important to have great social support with any chronic disease, which sounds like you're providing for the family. But other things to consider are a home safety evaluation, which can be done through a physical therapy office or a home safety eval or home health agency that's local to the area. They can come out to the home, assess what's safe and what's not safe for the patient and the family, and try to provide any recommendations of any instruments or any medical devices that they may need to help daily life be a little bit easier on them.
And, you know, the value of supporting each other, both for, it sounds like, the husband who has the chronic illness, but also for the caregiver, to make sure that the wife is getting the support she needs through support groups or through other agencies that can really focus on ways that they can support one another through this process.
I always encourage my patients with chronic diseases to look into the local chapters for their chronic disease, in this case, trying to find a local MS chapter that could help provide, just like Dr. Page was saying, resources for caregiver fatigue or for support systems for outings, and to provide a bigger community for those who might be suffering from the disease.
We certainly wish you and your neighbors the best, and hope that you do continue. I know you say it's, you know, it's awkward that you don't want to overstep your boundaries, but you're doing the right thing by being with them in this journey and supporting them as you are. Let's take our very next house call question, Erica.
I'm a freshman in college, and as we all know, college students live on a budget. Sometimes I'll eat food a little bit after the expiration date and will feel fine. Last week, I drank a glass of milk that was past its expiration date by a week and felt nauseous and had a stomach ache the day after. How bad is it to eat or drink expired food? Also, how long after its expiration date is it still okay to eat?
I think this is a great question, because I feel like we're all guilty of the sniff test to make sure that food hasn't gone bad or it's not too spoiled before trying it. And this is a very hard subject to give you a definitive answer on, because the expiration dates are placed on foods based off of the fact that that's what the manufacturer guarantees the food will be fresh. Now, there's no guarantee to say that you may not get an illness with the food if you eat it before the expiration date, but there could be an increased risk of having certain bacteria that could be present in the food and leading to illnesses kind of similar to what you had with nausea, vomiting, and possibly diarrhea.
Yeah, so that's really, I mean, usually the worst thing that's going to happen is you're going to get food poisoning symptoms and feel really yucky, maybe throw up, have diarrhea, you might get a fever. I mean, you could get some of the bad kinds of food poisoning that could even give you like bloody diarrhea or infections that way. And you could get really dehydrated. I would say, you know, brainstorm with your friends, with your parents of foods like canned goods. There are things, those little Roman noodles that all the college students live on. Amir, I'm sure you've got suggestions. Where's some cheap foods there that hold for a long time?
There was always a package of ramen noodles in the fraternity house when I was here at UNC. So I think trying to find foods that don't perish, or even having a potluck and making it a fun event to where you maybe clean your fridge out once a week and invite your friends to eat the foods that are coming up on their expiration date.
Yeah, sit down. You know, that's a reasonable question to ask your parents and kind of look at your budget and figure out a way that you can eat healthy foods and make some good choices and not have to eat rotten food and get sick. Be careful. All right. Thank you for your question. That was a fun one. Let's take our next one, Erica.
I have been on birth control for roughly 7 years, and I'm now interested in changing my pill to Seasonal, the one that gives you a period every 3 months instead of every month. I like the idea of not experiencing PMS symptoms every 28 days, and I feel sure my husband could say the same thing. I'm a little concerned that this is too long for my body to go without a period. What are your thoughts on this specific birth control?
So Seasonal, for those of you who don't know, is a form of what we like to call a continuous birth control, and it's just like taking a normal birth control pill, but you take the what we consider the active pills continuously for 3 months as opposed to a 3 week with an inactive period in a normal birth control pill.
And, you know, a lot of people really like having a period every month to reassure you that you're not pregnant. But in terms of the safety of having a period once every 3 months, you know, that is established. You may have some spotting and you'd be more likely to not know if you're pregnant if you're not taking the pills, you know, very regularly. So that would be important. But I think having fewer periods and lighter periods is one of the main advantages why a lot of people like to take these particular longer acting or longer daily medicines with fewer periods.
Absolutely. This is something that I offer to my patients who have issues with heavy menstrual cycles and pain associated with them, and even with migraine-associated menstrual cycles as a way to give them relief from those symptoms in a longer term.
Okay, let's take our next house call. Our last house call of the day.
I was cleaning out my bathroom cabinets the other day and found some prescription bottles I forgot I had. I always make sure I properly dispose of the ones I don't take anymore by taking them to the pharmacy. But for the medications I continue to take, I'm curious if they're still good. Is it safe to take the medications after their expiration date? Are there specific medications that don't expire?
I think this is a very good question because this is something that's very important, especially if you're on multiple medications.
And just for our listeners and for those of us in the room, how many people have medicines in your cabinet that are expired? Raise your hand, but not if you're driving.
Absolutely.
I'm raising mine. Amir, I'm sure you do too. We all have this. And so this is such a very practical question.
Very practical. And I think one of the most important things are medications that you take on a daily basis, such as medications that some people may take for heart disease, or antibiotics that you may take for prior illness. Those are medications that are very important to have the right dose. And so what happens in medications over time is they may lose their efficacy or their dose. So dropping those medications off at the pharmacy after their expiration date is probably the best idea.
And, you know, if you have a question about something, take it to your pharmacist. The pharmacists are very well trained, not just to dispense the medicines, but they know and can help you investigate the safety of your particular medicines. I would say anything that's life-saving or that you're requiring for treatment, antibiotics, nitroglycerin, if you take that for chest pain or heart problems, any medicines that are in a liquid or a suspension that's been sitting there over time, like if you had some amoxicillin for a child and it's been sitting there over time, probably just collecting yucky resistant bacteria, I would say those would be ones to definitely throw away and make sure you have the active ingredients.
Yeah. And in general, maybe some medications that are over the counter, such as Benadryl or Tums, those would probably be safe to keep on after the expiration date because the illnesses that they're treating in usual are not life threatening.
Yeah. Check with your pharmacist on that. I tell you, we've had great questions today about taking expired medicines, about eating expired foods,
about the efficacy of long-term birth control pills,
and about some of the challenging of supporting our neighbors and loved ones through chronic illness. Thank you for your questions, and thank you for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. We want you to share your questions, write your stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at Your Health Radio. You can follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, on iTunes. Get our health app where you can listen to all the shows and also write questions directly to us by searching one word, Your Health, for a free download at the App Store.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Professor George Annis. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Amir Barzin.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.